Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Staton. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge, members of the court. It's a pleasure to be back in the beginning of the term. On behalf of former Staff Sergeant Timothy Staton, it's a pleasure to be here before the court. The main issue before the court, in fact, the sole issue before the court, is whether the military judge abused his discretion by admitting evidence that the appellant may have attempted to kill or injure the former Chief of Military Justice and the former trial counsel under Military Rule of Evidence 404B.
Is it attempted to kill or injure or attempted to intimidate?
In our opinion, Your Honor, it is unclear, but we believe that the panel could have viewed it any one of those three ways.
But her testimony was that she didn't think he was trying to kill her.
Well, we don't believe that her testimony as to what his intent was should have been admitted at all.
But it was. I mean,
that's part of our argument, Your Honor, is that her testimony as to what his intent was should not have been allowed. The question is whether such evidence was not we believe that such evidence was not probative as to his consciousness of guilt, and any probative value was significantly outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. As such, the results of the appellant's court-martial are not reliable, and the findings and the sentence must be reversed. Your Honors, I think it's always important in these cases and helpful to the court to take sort of a look back and figure out how this evidence got admitted. As you know, the government filed notice under 404B, and an Article 39A session was held. And it's important to sort of take a look back at what the military judge looked at first, and then how that evidence sort of segued into the evidence that came out before the members. Captain Gilmore, the Chief of Military Justice, testified for the government and gave her version of events. And we would like to point out two things. You have the testimony in the joint appendix, but we would like to highlight two things. First off, as we just talked about, Judge, the military judge asked her opinion, and this is at JA 39. We believe that her opinion as to what happened, as with any opinion on a specific intent offense, would be irrelevant. We argue that her opinion is irrelevant both as to the motion and as to what happened before the members. And as we go forward in this case, you'll see that when she testified before the members, the military judge again elicited that information from her. What do you believe his intent was? What did you take from all of this? And it's also important, if you look at the joint appendix at page 223, you'll see sort of a sketch that came out before the members and at the 39A session as to what she alleges occurred. And it's interesting because you'll see that there's this sketch of, you know, the car coming at her and coming around her, and there's this question as to whether or not his actions towards her were premeditated. And it's going to become important as we get later on in the argument, members of the court.
I'm confused.
I'm sorry.
What did you appeal in this case? Are you appealing that is your argument that somehow she was allowed to offer improper opinion evidence or something?
Well, that's part of the argument.
I thought this was a 404B case involving the application of the Reynolds test.
We're getting to that right now.
Which part of the Reynolds test are you doing right now with the opinion stuff?
What I'm trying to do, Your Honor, is to lay the foundation of parts 2 and 3 of the Reynolds test, Your Honor. We're certainly not arguing part 1 of the Reynolds test.
Okay. Perhaps you could move on to the Reynolds test.
Exactly where I'm heading, Your Honor.
Okay.
Immediately after that, Your Honor, she then testified on the merits as to the exact same two issues. The military judge entered findings of fact and conclusions of law. And on the joint appendix at page 172, he asked her, did you consider this an attempt to intimidate you? And she testified, yes, it does. Yes, I did. And then we get to the Reynolds three-prong test. And as we just said, Your Honor, we concede that the first prong of the test was met. The second prong of the test, the government argues that this was admitted as a consciousness of guilt. We would argue that the exact opposite is true. There is no evidence to support whatsoever that this is a consciousness of guilt. There is no evidence in the record and no evidence in case law to support the government analogy and the military judge's conclusion that this is analogous to the intimidation of a witness.
What about Copeland?
Well, Copeland, Your Honor, actually argues the exact opposite.
Well, not on the second element, do they?
Oh, I believe it does, Your Honor, because what Copeland tells us is this. In Copeland, the military judge talks about this exact issue. Not the military judge, rather the federal judge talks about this exact issue. when we are talking about a witness, he says that there would be obviously certain benefits to a witness not testifying, spoliation of evidence. And for example, Your Honor, you could look at this exact case as the perfect example of that. If CJ or if Mrs. Staten were to not testify in this case, there would certainly be benefits.
This isn't a spoliation case. This is a consciousness of guilt case. Why don't you address consciousness of guilt?
Okay, well, I was trying to, in answer to the military judge, the judge's question, Your Honor, I was trying to...
Counsel, let's go back and finish your answer to Judge Erdman's question.
Okay. Because when we are dealing with an issue of spoliation of evidence, if a witness does not come in and testify, then there are benefits certainly to an accused. That is the second prong of Reynolds, and that is what the judge in Copeland was talking about.
But in Copeland, we had an individual who overheard the defendant say that he wanted to get the prosecutor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the judge said, ultimately on that issue, that might show some evidence of consciousness of guilt and disposed of it on the third prong. And so as long as we're talking about the second prong, why would not the situation in this case show some evidence of consciousness of guilt similar to what happened in Copeland?
Well, I think that what the judge was saying, he said it would show some de minimis consciousness of guilt. I don't think he said, I think the exact language that he used was that a very low evidence of consciousness of guilt, was my recollection from Copeland.
But it seems to me that they dispose of it on the third prong rather than the second prong.
I would disagree, Judge. I believe that, I would disagree. I think that he says that it has some very low evidence of consciousness of guilt. And I think in this case, Your Honor, you know, when you're dealing with consciousness of guilt, I think the key to address, Your Honor, is this. When an accused has consciousness of guilt, it is because he knows what a witness is going to say. And therefore, if he intimidates a witness in some way, it's because he knows what that witness is going to say. He has consciousness of guilt as to what that witness is going to say.
Doesn't he know what the trial counsel is going to say?
Does he know what? I'm sorry, Joe?
Doesn't he know what the trial counsel is going to say?
Well,
the trial counsel is going to try and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty.
But another trial counsel is going to come in and do the exact same thing.
Right.
What about the charges? They could be changed, affected. The manner of the argument could be adjusted.
By making it worse for the appellant, not better.
Well, not if you're successful in intimidating the person. If you're successful in intimidating them, maybe they'll back off.
But I think
that's what intimidation is.
Your Honor, I think in the military context, we have to realize that that is particularly untrue in a military context, because you're dealing with somebody who is told from the beginning of the time that they enter into military, we're dealing with a particularly unique environment, which makes it even worse than it would in the Copeland case, because you've got issues of disrespect towards an officer, assault upon an officer, and a military accused, unlike the accused in the Copeland case, is going to know that any sort of intimidation of an officer, any sort of an assault upon an officer, is not going to make things better for him, is not going to make this case go away, is going to know that this thing's only going to get worse for him. It's not going to get better.
Counsel, to follow up on Copeland.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your discussion of Copeland one in which you're seeking to distinguish this case from Copeland in terms of the legal theory that was set forth in Copeland, or in terms of the factual circumstances in this case? And if it's the factual circumstances, what is our standard of review?
Well, the standard of review overall in this case is obviously an abuse of discretion, Judge. I'm not really trying to distinguish Copeland much at all. I think the only distinguishing facet of this case between Copeland is that in Copeland, the federal judge in Copeland found that it was harmless error, which I would argue does not apply in this case. But other than that, I think that the main distinguishing factor between this case and Copeland is that the military judge in our case did not find Copeland and did not cite it in his findings of fact, and that the Air Force Court, when they cited Copeland, misinterpreted it. I would like to move on.
What specific aspect of Copeland did the Air Force Court misinterpret in your view?
Well, the Air Force Court in Copeland said that And I'm just drawing a complete mind blank now, Your Honor, and I apologize
for
that.
You can address that in rebuttal.
I'll address that in rebuttal, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I would like to move on to the third prong of the Reynolds test, which I do believe is the most important one in this case, which is the danger of unfair prejudice. We believe in this case substantially outweighed any probative value. The danger of I'm sorry, Judge.
I didn't have a question.
Okay, I thought I saw your hand being raised. I think it's your left-handedness, Judge, and the pen went up. The danger of unfair prejudice in this case is extremely high. And I would note you to the Guerrero case, which we cited in our brief. And in the Guerrero case, the judge in that case said that threat evidence arouses, and I'm quoting, a sense of horror and provokes an instinct to punish. And the Guerrero case also talks about whether there is a need for the evidence, and we cite that to our brief. In this particular case, the most significant issue in this case, and indeed probably the gravamen of the government's case, or the defense case rather, was whether the appellant's conduct fell within the continuum of parental discipline. And as you'll recall, the government's case was that the appellant was simply a monster, that he was somebody who was simply out to wreak havoc and to punish the stepchild. The defense case was, to some degree, that some of these acts did not occur, but the majority of the defense case was that this was an honest, albeit misguided, attempt at parental discipline. That's what the defense was relying upon. Well, obviously, at this point, any further evidence that the appellant was acting out of rage and any further evidence that the appellant was inflicting punishment or inflicting anger or inflicting pain or attempting to inflict pain on somebody else was going to tip the scales in favor of the government. So what did the government do? The government did what any trial counsel would do, which would end their case with the best evidence that they have that the appellant is a person acting out of violence. And they ended their case with the most volatile evidence that they had, which as used their evidence, ended their case with hard to drive home their point that the appellant was not disciplining his child, that the appellant was a loose cannon who would snap at the least provocation to inflict pain on others. And this evidence fit their argument perfectly. And the government, in fact, drove this home during their closing argument. This was an escalation of violence, and the appellant was out of control. And remember, Your Honor, sort of the way that this case flowed through. The government's case started with a number of witnesses who testified about things, and you can look at the magistrate judge who testified. You can look at Mrs. Crow or Crow who testified, in which the appellant said things like, I just snapped. I snapped. I took this too far. And the government continues this theme over and over again, and they culminate it with the Chief of Justice. And you'll recall, in fact, that during the Article 39A session, the military judge had some trepidation about her even saying the words that I was the Chief of Justice in this case. And what's the first thing that she says during the trial, her testimony on the merits? I was the Chief of Justice in this case, putting that premature of authority and this evidence comes out.
You're making a very persuasive case that this is probative evidence, but the prejudice comes from the fact that you think it's character evidence. What's the problem here? Because you obviously don't want this evidence in because it is indicative of the person's behavior. What's the legal error?
The legal error is that this evidence should not have come in because it was simply brought in to prove the fact that this is a bad person who was prone to violence, who was prone to snap. It is character evidence, plain and simple.
Not consciousness of guilt, but character evidence of guilt.
What about the limiting instruction?
Well, Your Honor, our argument is that when evidence should not come in, no limiting instruction is going to cure it.
Ever?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Ever? There's no way a limited construction can cure error in the instruction of evidence.
Well, I mean,
with regard to prejudice.
I mean, our argument, Judge. I'm sorry. I thought you said amber.
No, ever.
I'm sorry. I misheard the question completely, Judge. I'm sorry. I mean, our argument, Judge, is evidence should not come in. So therefore, when you put a limiting instruction on evidence that should not come in, to us, that does not cure the problem.
Counsel, are you talking about a distinction between perhaps a limiting instruction and an instruction to disregard? In your response to Judge Erdman, were you suggesting that if it came in error, no instruction would be successful? Or are you arguing that the judge's instruction in this case, being a limiting instruction, was an instruction that allowed the evidence to come in and then channel the manner in which the members could consider it.
Well, I mean, if I'm understanding your question correctly, Judge, I'm not sure that the military judge was going to admit evidence and say, you should disregard this evidence that just came in. I mean, if
he did not say that. Did the judge say to disregard this evidence?
Right. I mean, if it's evidence that comes in incorrectly, then a military judge gives an instruction that says you should disregard this evidence that just came in.
I thought that what you were saying was that it did come in incorrectly because it was character evidence, and you were then asked, but what about the limiting instruction, which specifically told them that they could not use it for that purpose, that they could use it for a limited purpose if they believed that it had happened and that it showed consciousness of guilt.
When I say it came in incorrectly, Judge, just so we're clear, I mean, we argue that this evidence should not have come in at all.
Because
it is improper character evidence. And that it is not brought in, it should not be brought in as consciousness of guilt because it is not consciousness of guilt.
Because such evidence can never be consciousness of guilt because the evidence in this case was not consciousness of guilt. Why?
Because the analogy that the military judge used, that evidence of intimidation of a trial counsel is equivalent to evidence of intimidation of a witness, was an improper analogy, and that his application of the law was incorrect.
And is your argument, Judge Ryan, did you have a follow-up? Is your argument there that intimidation of a trial counsel can never be used as consciousness of guilt, or is your argument that under the facts of this case does not establish intimidation of a trial counsel demonstrating consciousness of guilt?
I have learned long ago to never use nevers and evers.
Well, tell me what your answer is.
Well, Judge, because I'm not sure that I'm sure that there is some hypothesis somewhere out there in which a particular trial counsel in a particular case may have a particular bent against a particular accused in which an accused, you know, and Copeland was an example in which that particular accused believed that that particular trial counsel had it in for him, and that removal of that particular trial counsel may have benefited him. There may be a case in which the removal of a particular prosecutor may benefit an accused. There was no evidence of that sort in this case. Under the particular facts of this case, there was no benefit to this accused of removal of this trial counsel, and as such, the military judge's analogy of removal of the trial counsel and removal of the witness was incorrect.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
Is there further questions from the bench? You'll have a further opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Captain Joseph Kugler, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, I represent the United States in this matter. The appellant began by attempting to, even in the framing of the issue, exaggerate the prejudicial impact by changing the issue to whether or not from intimidate to kill or injure trial counsel. And in his brief, he says that the prejudicial effect of the contested evidence cannot be overstated. In fact, it can be overstated and has been overstated.
Do you think it was minimal, as the judge concluded? In the 4-3 balancing, the judge concludes that the danger of unfair prejudice is minimal. There is a risk here that you, let's say it's appropriate as consciousness of guilt, but is there not also a risk that the members would look at it as a character flaw, that this is someone who flies off the handle?
There is that risk, and there is, I would argue there is that
you
same
that
risk.
Minimal risk? Seems pretty high here. This is a guy who's flying off the handle all the time.
Yes, Your Honor. And before I got to get to the Reynolds analysis, my hope was to actually go to that even if this court were to consider that error, that error should be considered harmless, just as it was in Copeland, using the analysis set forth in United States versus Kerr, United States versus Pruitt, and Copeland itself. So I would like to first address the prejudice analysis so that even if this court were to consider it, the government's position is that in light of the overwhelming evidence in this case, that it was harmless error.
Sounds like you're conceding error.
No, no, Your Honor. I just want to ensure that I go through that.
You're just working backwards?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your working backwards scenario, if we're assuming error, are you assuming error on the 403 balancing or on the second thing?
If there were any error, the government's position would be on the 403 balancing test. We're not conceding error. We will be.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Go ahead and do your practice thing. I just wanted to.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Make sure I understood.
In going through the framework set forth in United States versus Kerr, the first question to ask is looking at the government's strength of the government's case. And in this case, the evidence was overwhelming. You had the testimony of CJ, the child in this case. That testimony outlined a catalog of abuse, including hitting with a golf club, belts, bruising, and ultimately culminating in the child's head being used to dent drywall. All of this was corroborated by the testimony of his mother. And while the appellant at trial did his best to cast doubt on the credibility of those two witnesses, we had much more evidence in this case because we had a series of admissions from the friends and co-workers of the accused, from neutral third parties, and from the appellant himself. These admissions included Tech Sergeant Hamilton, a defense good military character witness, that stated that CJ's head was hit against drywall. He heard this from appellant.
Counsel, rather than cataloging the facts, the rather ugly facts that were adduced at trial,
yes, Your Honor.
You know, assume that we've read your brief and that we understand your argument with respect to even if error, no prejudice. Could you please focus on the 403 balancing test and give me the government's position as to whether this would be the same case or a different case if the military judge had not given the limiting instruction that he gave?
Your Honor, it would be a different case had the military judge not given the limiting instruction. Certainly that limiting instruction prevented the members from abusing the evidence that was given. They were only allowed to consider the evidence of intimidation for the purpose of considering consciousness of guilt if, in fact, they believed that it did establish any evidence of consciousness of guilt. So in that way, it eliminated the possibility for prejudice in this case. As the court has held in previous cases, the members are presumed to have followed the instructions.
Would you agree that if an instruction had not been given, that saying that the risk of unfair prejudice was little would be incorrect, or was minimal would be an incorrect statement?
Yes, Your Honor. In any case where intimidation evidence or threat evidence was put in, had the judge left it to the members to consider it in any manner in which they chose, we believe that would certainly increase the prejudicial, the possibility.
So you agree with the appellant on the whammo effect of threat evidence, basically.
Well,
the assertion that it is peculiarly effective.
Well, consciousness of guilt evidence, or I think.
Well, I'm talking about a particular kind of evidence. I'm talking about evidence that the appellant threatened someone, whether it be a witness, whether it be the trial counsel, and you know the appellant cited a case called Guerrero to the effect that it's peculiarly effective. Are you saying you agree with that, but that the instruction saved it?
Your Honor, I would say that it's within a category of evidence that, given to the members without instruction, certainly could make it more prejudicial.
Thank you.
Not certain that it's the most prejudicial evidence, but yes, Your Honor.
Wait, does that mean that it is not consciousness of guilt evidence, or it is consciousness of guilt evidence?
No,
the fact that it's effective, another word for effective, can be probative.
Proof. Yes,
so
Your Honor.
The fact that it's effective doesn't mean it's proper or improper. So are you conceding that it's not consciousness of guilt evidence?
No, Your Honor. Our position is that it is, in fact, consciousness of guilt evidence. Moving quickly through the Kerr factors without cataloging each one of the testimony, it's important to look at all of the witnesses' testimony that highlight the admissions the appellant made to his friends, coworkers, and colleagues.
Counsel, the issue that we had briefed and that we wanted you to talk about was whether the military judge has abused his discretion in admitting evidence, and I understand that the fallback position is the one that you're talking about, but could you please focus your argument on the issue that we granted and that we asked you to discuss?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll move now to the application of the Reynolds factors. The military judge properly admitted the evidence of the appellant's intimidation of trial counsel as consciousness of guilt evidence. United States versus Reynolds is the proper test to apply, and as the appellant has stated during his argument in his brief, there really is no dispute as to the first element, whether or not there was enough evidence to go to the members that this event actually occurred. The dispute that the appellant takes with the admission of this evidence is really with the second and the third prong. First, dealing with the second prong, there is a fact of consequence, and that is that this threat or intimidation of trial counsel was evidence of consciousness of guilt. At the trial court below, the trial counsel argued that this was analogous to a threat made against a witness. And threats made towards a witness are admissible as consciousness of guilt. The judge analyzed this under whether or not it was consciousness of guilt and, in fact, was presented by trial defense with the same arguments appellant raises today, namely that there should be some sort of bright-line rule that distinguishes threats made against a witness and threats made against a prosecutor. And the government believes that there should be no such bright-line rule. As this court was discussing with appellant, there, in fact, in Copeland, they found that it was relevant and really settled the issue on the third factor. There should be no bright-line distinction between threatening a witness and threatening a prosecutor because one is threatening the witness that will testify and the other is threatening the prosecution who's going to bring forth that testimony. The facts of this case make this particular prosecutor that was the subject of this threat the face of the prosecution. She was the trial counsel for 1 year on this case. She was also the individual who the accused saw at two Article 32 hearings. She was also the trial counsel who preferred both charge sheets on the accused. Thus, this prosecutor was uniquely identified with the prosecution team, and a threat or an attempt to intimidate her indicates consciousness of guilt.
Now, counsel, does the concept of consciousness of guilt would seem to suggest some degree of rationality in the person's thought process. That is, in contrast to the irrationality of the character behavior, which the judge said that they could not consider, that there would be some thought process that the person would go through and say, if I intimidate this prosecutor, something good is going to happen to me. What was put on the record in this case to demonstrate a benefit to the defense from an act of intimidation?
Your Honor, there was no specific evidence put forth as to what the accused was thinking. However,
not necessarily what the accused was thinking, what anybody would reasonably deduce from this situation. That is, let's assume that the court will agree with the government that intimidation of a prosecutor can, in some circumstances, constitute consciousness of guilt. What evidence was put on the record in this case that this particular act, the manner it was conducted, would have any benefit from the accused, such as to show consciousness of guilt?
Your Honor, the only evidence I can point to is the evidence I outlined previously, which was that this trial counsel was particularly associated with this prosecution, being the trial counsel for 1 year, having sat at two Article 32 hearings, and having also been the individual who preferred charges twice. And I would agree with the court in the sense that this isn't a logical step for the accused to take and or the appellant to take. And I would agree with the appellant that it doesn't appear to be something that would ultimately benefit him. But I don't think that logic or well-reasoned thought are required in this case, because I would argue that threatening a witness in the case would certainly not be well-reasoned or logical behavior either, and ultimately would likely also result in similar detrimental effects. It is true that the military...
I think that is not necessarily the case that we see in civilian life, certainly, where intimidation of witnesses is regarded by certain elements as a very rational approach to freeing themselves from criminal consequences.
Your Honor, I would agree with that. I think that most of us here would agree that though those elements believe that it's rational, we would tend to disagree. And I would argue that there are other individuals who think threatening a prosecutor may well be something that's rational for them to do in different...
Would the unique circumstances of military life adverted to by appellate's counsel perhaps make a difference here?
Your Honor, I think these are all factors that the members had to consider, and this was the framework that the instructions gave them to consider. They had to first consider whether or not they believe the events occurred, and then consider only if it was consider the evidence only if it pointed towards consciousness of guilt. So these arguments were ultimately what was put, or these questions were ultimately what was put to the members when they were asked to consider. One, do you believe that this occurred? Two, do you believe that this is evidence of consciousness of guilt? And then if you believe that it is evidence of consciousness of guilt, then and only then can you use the evidence for anything at all. And I...
Does the diminished logic in a military case, in this one in particular, then create a greater danger under the third prong of the rational of the Reynolds test as to improper use? That is, the less one can conceive of any rational basis for an individual engaging in this kind of behavior for purposes of intimidation, isn't that more likely to create the danger of improper use under the third, under the prejudicial use under the third standard of Reynolds? That is, to show that this individual was, as the prosecution otherwise was attempting to demonstrate in this case, irrational, impulsive, and inclined towards destructive behavior.
If I understand the court's question,
there was the less logic that one might attribute to the act of intimidation for purposes of showing consciousness of guilt, the less logic there is there, doesn't that then increase the danger that it will be misused under the third prong because it shows that we're dealing with an irrational, illogical, emotional, impulsive, aggressive individual?
I think I understand your question. First, the government will concede that this is not inconsistent with the appellant's actions, quite obviously. But the government will concede that there could be cases where there's stronger evidence of intimidation or a stronger tie to consciousness of guilt. But we believe there was a sufficient tie here. It's sufficient enough to go to the members with that limiting instruction, ensuring that they would consider the evidence only in that manner. When we look at the probative value versus the prejudicial effect and we compare it to Copeland, we see that this case had more reliable evidence, that the evidence was more probative and less prejudicial. Dealing with what happened in Copeland was jailhouse banter. It was one witness saying what he overheard in terms of future plans of the accused in that case. Here we have no such possibility that this is puffery or some future plan that ultimately may or may not come to fruition. We have the actual action. So in that sense, it's more probative of an intent to intimidate because it's actually occurred as opposed to
something. In Copeland, was it discounted as jailhouse banter or was it treated as evidence of the particular intent to intimidate?
It was not considered jailhouse. Well, it was considered an attempt to intimidate, as you say, Your Honor. However, what I'm saying is the strength of this evidence where the accused is actually seen through the windshield driving towards the prosecutor is more direct evidence of an attempt to intimidate. Nor did the testimony of trial counsel, as appellant intimates, in any way exaggerate what happened. Trial counsel did not say that he was attempting to hit her. In fact, she said that she believed that he was not intending to hit her and that he was only intending to intimidate her. That was the limited scope of what came out, making it less intimidating. Sorry, less prejudicial. The underlying acts were also relevant in consideration of good military character evidence. Prior to the testimony of this witness, a good military character witness had been put on by the defense during the government's case in chief. Admittedly, the format of the testimony was incorrect. It was extrinsic evidence as opposed to did you know or have you heard questions. The defense themselves had conceded that this evidence could come in as rebuttal to good military character evidence in that other format. The point made here is that just as in Kerr, when they analyzed the difference in format versus prejudice, that also should be considered by this court in lessening the prejudice. And finally, in terms of the prejudice effects, which has been discussed, minimization of the prejudicial, any potential prejudicial effect, was the proper instructions given by the military judge. Those instructions limited the scope with which the members could consider this evidence. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, may I conclude?
Yes.
Your Honor, the overwhelming evidence in this case, which consists of victim testimony fully corroborated by the testimony of his mother, and more importantly, by the testimony of appellant's friends, colleagues, and the appellant himself, recorded screaming at a magistrate in a civil proceeding, is overwhelming. The testimony catalogs the abuse of a child with belts, golf clubs, fly swatters, and ultimately using the child's head to hit drywall and leave dents, producing a headache and bumps with the child's head.
Counsel, what does that have to do with the issue?
Your Honor, that would go towards, if this court were to find error, that it would be harmless error.
You spend a lot of time on prejudice, and it almost seems like you're conceding that the main issue may be a good issue for the defense, and you're arguing that there was no prejudice. But what's your best argument here? What's your best issue?
Your Honor, I believe this is evidence of consciousness of guilt, and that is our best issue. However, I just wanted to ensure this court also had my position on the other issue.
Well, another way to look at it is that you want to ensure that the court was reminded of the underlying facts in the case, which don't necessarily have anything to do with the issue, which I think is not a wise tactic for government appellate counsel to take.
Your Honor, that was not my intention, so I apologize if I just wanted
to make sure that you were aware of that.
I understand, Your Honor. I'll move on.
Your time is about to expire, but take the time that you need to make a brief concluding statement.
The admission of the intimidation of the prosecutor was correctly admitted as conscious of guilt. The military judge did not abuse his discretion, which is the proper standard for his decision to admit this evidence. And the carefully crafted instructions that were provided to the military members ensured that it did not have the detrimental prejudicial effect that the appellant now claims resulted in error in his trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, first off, Chief Judge Efron, I wanted to go back to the one point that I promised you that I would go back to, which is the Air Force Court's misinterpretation of United States versus Copeland. It will actually segue nicely into the question that you asked the government appellate counsel. We believe that the Air Force Court miscited Copeland in its comparison of the intimidation of a witness and the intimidation of a trial counsel, in which they said that a similar rationale exists for the admissibility of evidence of intimidation of a prosecutor to show consciousness of guilt. As noted and as you discussed in your questioning of the trial counsel, we believe that there is a significant difference in the intimidation of a trial counsel or a prosecutor and the intimidation of a witness. We believe that the Air Force Court miscited Copeland and did not read Copeland correctly for that analogy. Your Honor, you asked a question of the government counsel, and we would like to address that question as well, as to what evidence was there as to what effect removal of a trial counsel will have on this case. And we believe that that is a question that merits further discussion. There was no evidence put on the record by the government as to what happens when a trial counsel is removed.
So you don't think that the military judge would have some idea of what would happen with what if a trial counsel is removed? You don't think that it would have any effect or any disruption in the government's case if the person that did the Article 32 investigation to further charges was removed from the case?
And the worst case scenario,
they're completely interchangeable and fungible, and it just doesn't matter regardless of what point they're at in the trial.
In this case, it doesn't appear to have been any effect. Case moved on as scheduled. There's no indication in the record of the case having been delayed at all, Judge.
So you think that that's what they needed to put on was evidence of that?
Some evidence as to what effect it had on either the docketing of the case or the timing of the case or what effect it had. And certainly anything before the members would have been helpful, Judge. But there was nothing put on either before the military judge or the members as to what effect this had.
Is there any requirement that the government put it on?
Well, I think certainly in terms of proving prejudice, I believe that there is, in terms of the third prong of the Reynolds test. I think it would have certainly been helpful for the military judge and certainly for a reviewing court. It would have been. And then finally,
Your Honor. And you'd be here saying there's a mini trial and it was a distraction, right?
Well, I think certainly in terms of the 39A judge and for the reviewing court, it would have certainly been helpful for this court or for the Air Force Court to have had that information before them. And finally, Judge, before I conclude, you asked about any evidence as to the comparison between a civilian court or the effectively threat of a witness. The Guerrero Court addresses that. I don't have time to address that in any detail, but as what effect the threat of a witness would have, I would address this court to the Guerrero decision. It does talk about what effects the threat of a witness can have in terms of the removal of a witness. I see that my time is up.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. In conclusion, Your Honor, the military judge erred by allowing this evidence in. The probative value of the evidence of the intimidation of the trial counsel was substantially outweighed by the unfair prejudice, as it did nothing more than bolster the government's case as to the negative character traits of the appellant in this case. Therefore, we would argue that the results of this trial are unfair, and we would ask this court to reverse the appellant's conviction. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.